Last time, for the benefit of you that weren't here, we were talking about factions, which is the primal enemy of government. And Madison had argued that the nature of man is such that factions form, even under the best of circumstances, because every guy is self-centered, self-oriented, and wants to do his own thing. And when you get a social group, you'll get maybe he wants to do his own thing. He finds three or four more people that want to do the same thing, and they form a little pressure group to, you know, to get their thing and to impose their thing on the rest of the community. Meanwhile, there's another group that's forming, and it's going to do its thing and force its will on the rest of the community. And, you know, you have this kind of struggle going back and forth, and the primary function of government is to control faction, so that people don't fight one another, destroy one another, hurt one another. And so the government has two kinds of jobs, one of which is to control factions, second one of which is just the very opposite, to enable people to be as safely factious as possible, you know, so that everybody, as much as possible, can do his own thing and do what he wants to do. And so its primary function is regulatory. Now, this is a unique kind of an idea. It's the kind of idea that was not typical of the time at all, and still is very untypical of the time today. Because the name of the game today is to come up with your own ideology and then push it through and force it through, and that's what your country stands for. See, and so you're communists and you're building the great stateless communistic society of tomorrow. And you got a whole body of doctrines that are believed in by all the faithful. And everybody better believe it or else. Or you're fascists and you got your doctrine about, blood, soil, and sweat. You know, and we are going to build the greatest nation in the world and we will have the great culture. You know, and you can add race to it if you want, as Hitler did. But anyway, you have a whole body of beliefs, and the government exists to enable you to create that, to make that belief system become a reality. In the United States of America, there's no belief system except the belief in an inalienable right of every person to do whatever he wants as much as possible, so long as he doesn't interfere with somebody else doing what he wants in the pursuit of happiness. And happiness is undefined. It's left up to the individual to define happiness. All right, so the function of government then is to create a set of relationships where this can as much as possible be achieved. And the government is being successful if most of the people are reasonably happy. And it's unsuccessful if they aren't. And in addition, one other thing has to be built in. Durability. You have to have a kind of structure which is going to survive everybody pushing and tugging against it. It's got to be able to survive a 1960s when you got all kinds of young people disobeying the police and disobeying government and protesting this and protesting that. Is it going to overthrow the government? Is it going to destroy the Constitution, or is the Constitution going to outlast it? Well, the Constitution outlasted it. A kind of Constitution which hopefully is put together in such a way, and the Federalist people also agreed with Jefferson, the Constitution was put together in such a way that even if rascals were the government, it would survive, that if rascals held the offices, the government would survive and the people would survive. And so, can the Constitution survive Watergate, or does Watergate end up overthrowing the Constitution? Well, the Constitution survived. Well, there are alternatives to the way that they proposed, and in book number 10, letter 10 of the Federalist Papers, which discusses faction, which I discussed on Wednesday, there were a number of alternatives set out there of directions that things might go. And I thought it might be interesting, before I get on to the last topic that I promised, to comment a little bit on the alternative directions to the one that Madison proposed. He had suggested that, first of all, we could attempt to solve the problem of faction by getting at the cause of faction or by getting at the effects of faction. And he said we can't go at the cause of faction because if we wipe out the cause of faction, we will wipe out the reason for government, namely the preservation of liberty. So one alternative would be to destroy individual liberty. Then you get rid of faction. Now, this is a kind of direction which has been tried. This is the kind of direction that we today call fascist. And any kind of fascist direction, any kind of direction on the part of government which attempts to suppress people and to force them all into a common line is a fascist direction. It is an effort to wipe out factionalism. It is an effort to get uniformity, universal agreement. You whip everybody into line, and nobody objects. Anybody that objects gets thrown in jail or gets executed. And governments have oftentimes taken that kind of approach. Matter of fact, this is the kind of approach which first comes to mind with every government, including the United States government, when they get opposition, even if it's opposition of the other political party. Somehow or other, you destroy them. You know, whether you bug their headquarters and find out what they're doing and neutralize their strategy, or whether you manipulate law enforcement, or whether you work up a false case and get them taken to court and thrown in jail, so they can't be a worthy opponent in the election. You know, the whole dirty tricks business, which every political party engages in, is this kind of approach, where you achieve uniformity, namely your party winning, by destroying the opposition. The opposition's freedom of operation, in one way or another. So that's rather common. Rather commonly tried, and it's one of the kinds of things that we have to watch for and prevent if we're going to continue to have a free government. Second kind of approach, he says, from a causal standpoint, is to give every citizen the same opinion, same interests, and the same passions. Now, this is the kind of approach which in the last century or so has been typical of all communist forms of government, where you develop an ideology and then you operate your society in such a way that everybody becomes committed to the ideology. Now you do this by discussion sessions, by daily discussion sessions, by propaganda broadcasts, by in the factories and shops where the people work, you have loudspeakers with only volume controls on, and the lowest volume is still perceptible, but no on-off switches, and all day long they keep hearing party propaganda. As you are shaping a people who believe the same thing, feel the same thing, you know, it's like one body. So that's the kind of approach, but what happens here is we lose individuality. We lose individualism. And so obviously Madison and his friends wouldn't buy it, but better, almost half of the world today has bought that kind of approach. And so consequently, one of the kind of things that we have to be careful also for the sake of individuality is to avoid ideological commitment. You know, where we attempt to get a mass group with a common body of ideological political beliefs that are now to be enacted into law and enforced upon the rest of the populace. You know, whether our ideology being that it is sinful for man under any circumstances to let alcohol cross his lips, and it is the function of government to prevent man from sinning, therefore a dry United States, you know, whether it's that sort of thing or other sorts of things where we attempt to make certain forms of behavior illegal And this is very frustrating, particularly for Christian people. This is very frustrating because we would very much love to have everybody in the United States sharing Christian beliefs, right? And wouldn't it be terrific if the government helped? Tiana, you think about those terrific days when Charlemagne ruled the whole civilized world. It was a civilized world because it was our world, so it had to be civilized. And ruled the whole civilized world, and by golly, they were Christians. The first thing that you did after you conquered people was you informed them that they were now Christians. And you told them they could now cheer. You know, after they got, and then after they had gotten done cheering, then they could bandage their wounded and bury their dead. Those are the good old days when Christianity really grew nation by nation. Well, you kind of have the urge, particularly when you get frustrated about, looks like more and more people aren't Christians and the Christian community is getting pressed back. You keep thinking, gee, wouldn't it be terrific if we could simply legislate Christianity in the United States and then settle it once and for all? And I expect many a clergyman has thought, boy, wouldn't it be great if we had it like in Europe and we got our salary from the government and it came out of taxes, you know, instead of the goodwill or indifference of our loving parishioners. So those urges are there to go this kind of direction, rather than to be free and individual. One thing that Madison didn't think would ever be a problem, and that is his Achilles heel in his political theory, and that is the factious minority. Every group that has ever been dominant in the United States has been a minority. The United States has never been dominated by a majority. Contrary to what civil rights people or other people tell you, the majority has never ruled in the United States. Now, from a value standpoint, it has always been a powerful minority. Whether it was the railroad barons or the Wall Street magnates or the Kansas wheat farmer populace, you know, or who, what group it's been. Right now it's the oil industry in league with the Detroit automobile faction, you know, and the Ohio rubber industries, that are the dominating minorities. If you want to argue majority repression, you know, then you have to invent something, you know, like the white man, see, or males. Although males are numerically in the minority in the United States, but you talk about male repression. You have to invent a majority that is holding your minority down, but as a matter of fact, it is always a powerful minority that dominates a country. The Communist Party knows this, and so they deliberately see to it that they never exceed one-fifth of the population of a country. Recently, about 8 months ago, in the Soviet Union, the Communist Party did a purge. Nowadays, they do bloodless purges, which shows how secure they are. It's one of the signs of insecurity of a government is when they execute their opposition. This is a sign of weakness, not a sign of strength. And so the fact that they retired people rather than executed them indicates a certain security of government. All right, they had a purge of the party. Why? The party was getting too big. There were too many communists in the Soviet Union. And so they cut the number down, and a certain number of people were informed, send in your card, you're no longer a member of the party. They hadn't done anything wrong, they'd been perfectly loyal, there were just too many communists. And they simply got removed, because you can't afford to get too big. You get too big and you get lethargic and indifferent and you go to pot. And so you gotta, you know, it's like when we get overweight, right? See, like after yesterday. It's bad to go on hike all the rest of the day again, compensate for yesterday. You get fat, you get lethargic, you start making mistakes. First thing you know, you're thrown out. There's a revolution and you're on the losing side. So you got to keep yourself lean and efficient. And this Madison didn't realize, and his contemporaries didn't realize, because they believed that in a free government the threat was majority rule becoming oppressive. And so all that you had to do was to see to it that a majority was prevented from, a majority of the people were prevented from having the same kind of attitude about things, or that even if they felt it, it could be weakened and vitiated. And what they didn't realize was that all social change is brought about by minorities, and that majorities tend to function as a kind of conservative hold on progress. So they're like the brake, they're not the accelerator. And the majority tends to be the status quo group, and the minority tends to be the move backwards or move forwards group. It tends to be the it tends to be the shift and the accelerator. And for this reason, there was a certain kind of weakness there that they were unaware of and didn't write about, but we can compensate for it. And we can compensate simply by realizing that this is the case, and by realizing also that if one minority can get its will, another minority can get its will to replace that minority. And the name of the game is every minority viable. And we've seen this happen in the last 20, 25 years. For instance, in the 50s, the civil rights movement began to get going. Rights for blacks. What happens in the 1960s? We start getting going on rights for American Indians, right? Another minority group. Then we get rights for women and rights for Polish. You know, down with Polish jokes, and so on. We don't have rights for Irish because the Irish have got all their rights plus a few of ours. I say that coming from the Chicago area, which is run by the Irish. And, you know, and so on. But one group after another sees, hey, they got it. How did they do it? All right, now let's us do it. And then pretty soon you find the one faction competing with the other. And then the first one says, hey, let's not fight one another, let's join. And so then you get rights for blacks, Chicanos, and women. You know, and there's very little that blacks, Chicanos, and women have in common as far as the federal government is concerned. See? But then you know you start, yeah. But I mean, that's the thing that you share in common. And then you get some guys coming around and writing books and a couple of gals, and they talk about, man, the real oppressed minority, you know. And all of a sudden, one of these days, the guys are going to start organizing, and I can tell you exactly when. The first time that we have Monday night women's football. That's when the guys are all going to rise up in protest, unless they invent new kinds of uniforms for the girls. But, you know, one group after another then starts fighting for its rights. And what Madison visualized, and what Jefferson visualized, was a kind of country where people were conscious of what they wanted and were willing to stand up and argue for it. Knowing good and well that the next guy was standing up and arguing for what he wanted too. And they wanted a government which, from a structural standpoint, was sufficiently flexible that it could move this way and that way depending on popular sentiment. Who was hollering the loudest and most effectively? And the government could then be responsive to that. You know, it's sort of like, I guess they kind of visualize a sort of situation like when all the relatives get together. The whole family relation, and they're all in a big room like this, and everybody's talking at once. You know, all of us that have big relations know what that's like. See? And that's sort of the way they visualized it, and the function, I mean, the name of the game then was, you know, keep communication going as well as possible. You know, nobody's sitting quiet. Everybody actively involved in the politics business and the government business, because, you know, we're never going to have happiness if we sit and feel sorry for ourselves and talk about being oppressed. Get out there and get a piece of the action. And that was the way they visualized it, and they thought it could even be done good-humoredly. You know, you didn't have to have somebody you hated, because the oppressor, the guy you hated, you know, that was the other kinds of governments. And your, at least temporary enemy that was trampling on your rights was your fellow citizen. And I expect they figured that a good many of these feelings could get settled and ironed out simply by one group saying to another group, hey, that's my foot you're standing on, and the other group saying, gee, I'm sorry. See? And so I suspect to some extent also it was a function of the government to maintain an atmosphere of goodwill. But it was a kind of government where everybody had a stake in it, and where I suspect the success and the failure of the government depended on everybody feeling they had a stake in it and that their government would be responsive to them. And viewing the whole thing that way, you know, it's almost impossible to believe that these 13 states at that time could have bought this idea and also slavery. And as I mentioned the first day, the first thing that got knocked out of Madison's version of the Constitution was the provision against the importation of any more slaves. Out, instantly, not even debated. Well, obviously we can't have that in there. See? So how you could think of a people where you had a certain number of people who had no rights, or very few rights, that you had other people who were constantly getting pushed farther west. Well, I guess you could get along, you just push the Indians outside the country. So you're like sweeping dirt out of the house. But then when the country expanded, then there they were, and you had to push them farther. So you could do a kind of halfway solution until you reach the Pacific, and then what do? See, there's nowhere else you can push them, and they're not like lemmings, you know, that'll go over the cliff. So, there you were. But, you know, living when we do now, you wonder how it was possible with people with such enlightened political ideas to be so repressive with certain groups. And when did women get the vote? You know, in this century. And we're still trying to get things settled. And when did young people get the vote? Not too many years ago, right? Just in time to vote for Mr. Nixon. See, would you like to give it back? Okay. We won't debate partisan politics. No need to develop factions here this morning. But you see how johnny-come-lately we've been on things, and at the same time, what a terrific opportunity we have right now to discuss things like the Federalist Papers and say, look what the terrific opportunity we've had for two centuries, and look how often we've screwed it up. And what we've got to offer the world is a way of living together, and what the communists have to offer the world is a way of living together. You know, given the opportunity to do the one or to do the other, who wants to go the other way? I expect only the guy that's starving to death. You know, if they've got a warehouse full of bread. So, I suspect that we have tended not to appreciate what we can do with our government. And we have tended to spend too much time sitting and wondering what our government can do for us instead of using our government. You know, and one of the things that really bugs me is standing in respect for the President of the United States. I'm doubly bugged at standing in respect for the president of my Senate, but I never have. And that also includes sainted Dr. Beckett, for whom I never stood. And I was always reminded of Benjamin Franklin, who was, you know, our ace diplomat. never bowed to any of the crown heads of Europe. He was a citizen of the United States. He was no king's flunky, and he didn't bow. Including Louis the 16th and the late Louis the 15th. I think he knew Louis the 15th in his very last days, you know, the second most powerful king that France ever produced. He didn't bow. Why should he? He was that man's equal because they were both human beings. That man worked for the French people, only he didn't know it. He was their servant. And the government is our servant. And when we start thinking about the government as our servant, rather than us working for the government, you know, we talk about nowadays you have to work for a month and a half to pay for your government, you know, in taxation. Well, we stop thinking that kind of way and start saying, we give the government a month and a half worth of our pay and it better produce what we want.
Four months.
Is it 4 months now? All right, yeah. That's including Social Security, you know, which gets higher and higher and higher. So, but we tend not to call our government to account. We've got television, which is a fantastic opportunity for us, and what happens politically on television? Our senator uses it to report to his constituency. Our governor uses it to report to his constituency. How about the constituency calling the elected officials in and asking them questions? See, that's the way we ought to operate. And I repeat Samuel Adams' remark that I gave you at the beginning of a Village Forum discussion, and that is, the people who are in slavery deserve it. It's only people who deserve slavery that are in slavery. Because if they didn't want to be slaves, they'd do something about it and get out of it. Well, there's limits to that. See, many, many a guy has died with that on his lips. But still in all, it's our government. We're not its people. It's our government. And if we don't like the way it's operating, let's tell them we don't like the way they're operating. I suspect we've also got to come up with a more effective way of getting candidates than we have. Because in recent years, we've had some pretty lousy choices. You know, and more and more people are saying, for whom do you vote when you don't like any of the candidates? That's the primary reason why the majority party in the United States today is called independent. And the Republicans nationally are down to, I think, now under 20%. And the Democrats are about 35. No, even lower than that. They're about, I think the Republicans are about 18% and the Democrats are slightly under 35, which means that independent is a little more than 50%. And they don't seem to be catching on. You know, so they keep grinding out second raters and say, you know, he's a terrific guy, you know, well, how can we make him look good, ask the PR people to come in. You know, and the American people don't get fooled. But you gotta have somebody there, and everybody remembers how well Harry Truman worked out. And I guess if an old tie salesman can make a decent president, almost anybody can. You know, so we work with that kind of naive belief.
But he wasn't just a tie salesman.
No, that's right.
He had a lot of reading beforehand.
Right. But I mean, we have that kind of myth. And so we have a kind of feeling that the office makes the man. See, which I think is pretty well exploded now. But we've got to be more articulate, or the government doesn't work right. And if the government doesn't work right, it's our fault, because we are the motive power. We produce the energy that causes the governmental apparatus to operate. And if we sit and wait for somebody else to produce the energy that moves us around, well, there are plenty of little groups that are waiting to do that. Plenty of little factions that would be happy to take over and run it to their best interests. And so if we sit around and let them do it, they're going to do it. So we have to think of what it is that we want, what we don't like, articulate it, figure out how we're going to do it, find out other people who don't like it either, and get going and change it. And it'll change. Our government can change rather rapidly. All right, so much for number 10. One of the big problems which they had and which we have occasionally is the question of what kind of government have we got anyway? And it'll change. Our government can change rather rapidly. All right, so much for number 10. One of the big problems which they had and which we have occasionally is the question of what kind of government have we got anyway? Do we have a democracy? Do we have a republic? Do we have a mixed form of government? What is it? Well, the Federalist guys wanted to argue we have a republic, we don't have a democracy. And yet there were all kinds of countries in Europe that called themselves republics. Just as the N word for the last 100 years has been democracy. And so you got all kinds of democracies in the world. You have some South American democracies where they know they're democracies because their military dictator told them they were. See, and you've got every communist country is either a democratic republic, you know, or it's a people's republic, or it's a democracy, but it's not. So, the same thing was true at their time. Great Britain called itself a republic. Poland called itself a republic, and the king ran it with an iron fist. So they come up with it, they say this is a republic, and the definition of a republic is the following. A republic is a government which derives all of its powers directly or indirectly from the great body of the people and is administered by persons holding their offices during pleasure for a limited period, at the pleasure of the people for a certain number of years, or during good behavior. That means they've got tenure as long as they don't do bad things, a lifetime selection for office, so long as they are not guilty of wrongful behavior. A federal kind of government, a federal republic, is a republic which is authorized by a majority of state governments. A national republic is a republic which is authorized by a majority of people. Consequently, what we have is a federal republic. It was voted into existence by states, not by a general referendum of people. It was voted into existence by states, and so we have a federal government, and this is why we talk about the federal government and in a number of kinds of ways. And yet we have a kind of a mixture in operation. For instance, the House of Representatives is a national body, not a federal body. The Senate is a federal body. Each state has two representatives. So it's a federal type structure, not a national type structure. The House of Representatives in some sense or other reflects the composition of the people. The Senate, each state is represented. In the case of the president, at their time, it was mixed because he was elected by the Senate and House of Representatives. Today, presidency is a national office. Not because we elect him, but because we elect electors who elect him. But the electors reflect us. There aren't so many per state, or an even number per state, and so on. But they reflect, the electors reflect the election results. And so the presidency is a national election, and so on. All right, finally, on Federalist Paper 78, which is the one that Chief Justice Marshall depended on in deciding the very crucial question, who is the final voice in saying what the Constitution means? And he ruled that it was the Supreme Court that in the final analysis decides what the Constitution means, not the president or the legislative branch of government. And he based his argument on Federalist Paper 78. Fortunately for the way things have gone, nobody challenged his decision or the Federalist Paper base on which it, you know, on which it rested. The judges, the judicial branch of government, is the guardian of the Constitution. Now, Madison's argument goes this way. It is the least dangerous of all the branches of government. Consequently, it is the best suited of the three branches to protect the people's rights under the Constitution. The executive branch of government has the power of the sword. In other words, it is the force principle of government. It carries out action. And you sure don't want the boys that do the action to decide what actions are right and what actions are wrong, right? You sure don't want the military autonomous in deciding what it ought to do and what it ought not to do. You want civilian control. All right, so the executive branch, you sure don't want to decide what the Constitution means or doesn't mean, or in very short order, you're going to have yourself a dictatorship. The legislative branch has the power of the purse. They can tax you. In addition to which, they also make up the rules and regulations. Do you want them to decide what the Constitution means? Heavens no. What does the judiciary possess? It possesses the power of judgment. The power of judgment and nothing else. Who carries out the judiciary's decision? The executive does. And so consequently, he argues the judiciary should make the decisions. Now, it's a bit more subtle than that in his argument, because he says the judiciary has neither force nor will. And that word will immediately makes the wheels start turning, you know, because will is human psychology. And all of a sudden you realize that for Hamilton, and Hamilton wrote this paper, Hamilton is thinking of Platonic psychology, where the human psyche and the national state are analogized to one another. And there are three psychological parts. the reason, the will, and the affective or emotional side. Three parts to the human psyche. If the human psyche works well, if the rational part decides, the will obeys the rational part, and the emotions provide the, you know, the generative power. If you got the emotions running, an overwhelming reason, you screw it up. If somebody gets bullheaded and they're going to do it their way, regardless of what's right or wrong, you're going to have trouble. It's only when it runs in that kind of way. And the national government is the same way, said Plato. Well, what is Hamilton doing here? He's saying the executive is the expression of the passionate side of our nature. It carries things out. It wants to be doing things. And bear in mind, the executive is one man. A factious man, like all the rest of us. He's very strongly motivated by a desire for glory and to go down in American history as a great man. See, he's really, the adrenaline runs constantly and powerfully in his veins in the office. You know, a lot of energy there. We certainly don't want him, one man, deciding what the Constitution means, or we're going to be in all kinds of trouble. The legislative expresses the will. It makes decisions. We're going to go this way. We're not going to go that way. And the will of the legislature becomes the law of the land. Are we going to have the will decide what is correct and what is not correct? No. Reason has to do that. And where is reason? Reason is in the judiciary. So consequently, the function of the judiciary should be to think. To think about what the Constitution means and the intent of the Constitution, and to check and see that the laws which get passed at any time or other are consistent with the general will of the people expressed in the Constitution. And so the kind of structure that we have operating is this kind of structure. Those of you that have been here all along, if you'll think back to the second day when I talked about human psychology, you have a spring of action, a yen to do something, rather, that, and this is the start of an action. It just happens in you, right? May get stimulated by this, that, or the other thing. It's almost 10:15, and you know, all of a sudden your tongue is moist and you can just taste coffee, right? See? And it's starting to go now. And so the urge to get up and leave and go and get a cup of coffee over the snack bar is starting to build. And if you gave it no more thought, you'd get up and leave. And a lot of things we do that way. You sit here, all of a sudden your arm starts itching and you reach over and scratch it, right? You know, or you look over and there's a mosquito sitting there and you go like that and keep right on going. You don't think about it, do you? But the actions that we're conscious of, before we respond to the urge, we interpose deliberation. We think about it. And having thought carefully about it and sifted out alternatives and things of that sort, we then act. And so consequently, the initial image that we had gotten was the people have an urge for this, have an urge for that, have an urge for the other thing. And as we know now, there are gobs of urges competing with one another. Every faction has an urge, wants the government to move us this way, that way, and the other way. And then government interposes itself, gets all of these urges fed into it, deliberates over them, and then moves them all into a common direction. We call the law. So we move the whole thing and we use all those energies to move ourselves in a certain direction. What he is saying here is not only do we now have that screen there, the deliberation by the legislature before action, but we now have another screen of the judiciary that says, hey, you can't go that direction, that's unconstitutional. That's contrary to the way the people want it to go. in the broadest sense of the term. Go that way, you start eroding the liberty of the people and their right of individual decision, therefore you may not do it. And so long as we have that operating, and we have a judiciary with a sense of the national purpose and the function of national government, and a legislative and an executive obedient to it, the whole thing is going to work. Providing that we don't get lazy and sit back on our duff, because we provide the energy. And if we don't, and the energy doesn't come, if the energy doesn't come from us in expressing our will, the energy is going to come from us in tax money. And that's going to be the only energy we provide. While other people get the ideas and say, okay, we have gotten this idea and decide it's a good one and you will now pay for it. See? And so consequently, we've got to let our government know that we have more to offer than our money. And that we didn't hire them to think for us, we hired them to work for us. And we pay them well. See? And so as soon as the people start assuming the initiative, then the government's going to work better. And it's not going to be responsible to other interests. Because regardless of what interests influence and have recently influenced the American government, we outnumber them. And we do the voting. And there's no faction in the United States today that has so many votes that we can't outvote them. So if they win, it's our fault. See, because we still have the power to do something about it. And that's the Federalist Papers in a kind of a nutshell, and it's interesting to see all of the different philosophic currents that were fed into there, and rather sophisticated notion they had of what at first glance looks like a rather simple structure. And sometimes I thought the American government, if we'd only get rid of all of those bureaus that have made it fat. But the American government is, you know, purely as a structure, has been designed with the simple efficiency of a typical piece of German machinery. You know, and it's just few parts and very simple, and it works magnificently and it lasts forever. Not in the last few years, but it used to.
Not the Mercedes-Benz either.
No.
It's not a simple piece of German machinery.
Well, that's complicated. But we're starting to move back in the direction of the simple life also in vehicles, because we're beginning to discover that the more stuff you hang on there and the more moving parts you got, the faster it wears out, the more gasoline and oil you use up, and as the resources get thinner, we're moving back in the direction of simple operation. One of these days, somebody is going to rediscover the Ford Model T. Yeah, which every man can take apart and put back together again and repair, and we're starting to move back into that direction, hopefully, anyway. Any comments or questions? Yes, sir.
When you left with waste, or kind of the idea of waste, I would like to see a significant number of people here call one of their representatives about their vehicles at the Forest Service. Automatic transmissions, V8s, 8 miles to the gallon, one man wandering around, and call and find out how many those international trucks they have, and then take that times the number of trucks, and you've got a significant amount of waste. It's right here under your nose.
Okay. That's very nice.
Coming
That's
through here.
Good point.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we're beginning to form a faction. Good. Now bear in mind that faction isn't necessarily bad. I said that the other day. Faction isn't necessarily bad. That's what makes the country go, the forming of factions. Because that's where the energies are. See, the energy is aimed at this thing, energy is aimed at that thing. And you may belong to 15, 20 different factions. You're not just one faction. Oh, we're starting to form a faction. Good. I mean, a good faction. Good. Okay?
The
Latin verb facio, to do or make something. You know, you got a group that wants to do something. And that's what it ultimately means. You know, we have all kinds of doer groups. Do this, do that, you know. And in the sense of saying to the government, do this, do that, do this, do that. And we don't do enough of that.
It is true. I feel I'm amazed at how few people write to their senators and congressmen. That's better than calling, because if you get it on paper,
handwritten,
they have to have a letter that they can refer to in a sheet, you know, when they make a report to their constituency that they've answered so many letters. But they do know when you write to them that you pay enough attention to put something on paper. And they answer.
I think a letter with two, three phone calls behind it is good.
Throw your
letter in there first, and then two, three once a week, because telephone calls are getting pretty inexpensive.
Yeah, well, that also is a form.
What's that?
I think you can send a POM for $2. That's a telegram charge to your phone for $2.
Yeah.
You can get a lot said.
Yeah.
You can get a telephone call, I think, 22 cents a minute or something like that, clear across the United States. That's only 12 cents more than ours.
I guess we think in terms of the post office, because we can't have it all
the time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We all try to
do it. Okay, just want to make a personal comment. I thought yesterday was great, and I say it as a member of the planning committee, but what makes it great, you know, is having a full village. You know, it's different when the village is full. Come on back in August, right, Mary? Come on back in August. Still room. But, you know, the weather was great. The people were great. We had a feel of what it has always meant to be an American. And maybe we needed to feel that once again and, you know, and get going instead of feeling down and feeling low and feeling like there's nothing we can do. You know, it wasn't many people that started it. And most of the people were sitting around saying, oh, they're lousy taxes. And that's about all they were doing. My ancestors were getting their muskets cleaned up to fight for the British as Hessians. But, you know, as you leave the village, we hope you're going out with a renewed sense of what it means to be an American. Barbara?
On the 4th of July. If you stay home, you know, you look at firecrackers and all that, but I think the 4th loses its meaning completely, which I thought was so nicely brought out yesterday, like the reading of the Declaration of Independence. Mm-hmm. Who does that at home? And our kids, who just see firecrackers, think the 4th and firecrackers have no realization of what really the 4th is. I didn't miss the firecrackers at all, but I was really glad they weren't there. I felt it was really
illegal up here anyway.
Yeah, I thought it was really much more meaningful celebration, and to us it came out what the 4th really is and should be.
Good.
Well, and I think it was great to have a whole both sides, you know. And then they had that super ending, you know, and the poem is
yeah. But can you imagine the reaction back home when you tell them that the 4th of July ended with us all sitting there watching a paper airplane flying around the road? They'll think, what kind of a loony bin do they run up there?
They don't need that.
Okay. Have a good day and enjoy the euphoria of the 5th.